Hello and welcome to More or Less, the show that tracks down suspect statistics, traces who's been using them, and isolates them from the solid majority of data points which are healthy and reliable. I'm Tim Harford. This week, grand claims have been made about treating COVID sufferers with the blood plasma of COVID survivors. We pick the scraps of evidence out of a steaming heap of exaggerations. Is the virus spreading again in the UK? We look at the data. The BBC says that early breast cancer screening saves lives. Does it? And hopefully, time to investigate an astonishing claim about the number of sex workers in Georgian London before the end of the programme. So first, last Saturday, US President Donald Trump took to Twitter to complain about how the country's Food and Drug Administration, the body that authorises drugs and medical treatments, was part of what the president called the deep state, which is not a compliment. He added that the FDA was making it difficult for drug companies to test vaccines and therapeutics. Obviously, he wrote, they are hoping to delay the answer until after November the 3rd, the date of the presidential election. He tagged the commissioner of the FDA, Stephen Hahn, in his tweet. As if by magic, the next day there was a press conference at the White House, Donald Trump appearing alongside Dr. Hahn.
Today I'm pleased to make a truly historic announcement in our battle against the China virus that will save countless lives. The FDA has issued an emergency use authorization, and that's such a powerful term, emergency use authorization, for a treatment known as convalescent plasma.
Blood plasma makes up about half your blood volume, and after fighting off a virus, it should contain the antibodies that were used in that fight. Convalescent plasma therapy uses donated plasma from recovered patients to treat someone else who's sick with the same virus to help them fight it off. It is not new, far from it. It's been used for over 100 years to treat illnesses from influenza to Ebola and SARS. And according to Donald Trump, it is very effective in treating the virus that causes COVID-19.
Over 100,000 Americans have already enrolled to receive this treatment, and it has proven to reduce mortality by 35%. It's a tremendous number.
A tremendous number indeed, if true. And it wasn't just the president using it. Here's Stephen Hahn.
So let me just put this in perspective. Many of you know I was a cancer doctor before I became FDA commissioner, and a 35% improvement in survival is a pretty substantial clinical benefit. What that means is, if the data continue to pan out, 100 people who are sick with COVID-19, 35 would have been saved because of the administration of plasma.
That is a huge claim. It also makes no sense. Generally, of 100 people sick with COVID, we'd only expect one person to die. How could the deaths of 35 people be prevented then? But even if we give Dr. Hahn the benefit of the doubt and assume he meant to say out of 100 people who might have died from COVID, 35 would have been saved by this treatment, that only resolves one confusion among the many which are surrounding this claim. The evidence about the effectiveness of plasma originates from a study by researchers at the Mayo Clinic. That study is only published as a preprint, which means it hasn't yet been peer-reviewed. And one of the main authors of the study has said he doesn't know where the 35% number came from anyway. To try to get to the bottom of this, I spoke to Dr. Charlotte Summers. She's an intensive care doctor and a respiratory researcher at the University of Cambridge.
So what they did, and the basis on which that claim was made, there's quite a few things wrong with them. So the first thing is that actually this therapy is not therapy versus no therapy in this study. So actually they haven't got a study or any data from this study that supports that giving convalescent plasma is better than not giving convalescent plasma, because there's no control group in this study.
That means it's impossible to estimate the effect of receiving this treatment compared to not receiving it. Instead, they compare those who receive plasma with a low level of antibodies with those who receive plasma with a higher level of antibodies. The next problem is that the patients were not randomly assigned to receive the high or low antibody plasma. It's an observational study. which simply means that the researchers observed the results of decisions made on a case-by-case basis by doctors. This could easily bias the results, because doctors will tend to treat people who they feel are most likely to benefit.
So this study cannot, because of its design, suggest benefit. It's not able to because it's not randomised and there is no control group.
So where did the FDA and President Trump's claim of a 35% reduction in mortality come from?
The 35% claim comes from the fact that in the group of people who got given plasma with a high antibody content, at 7 days, 8.9% of them died. Whereas people who got given plasma that had a low antibody content, 13.7% of them died. Now, 8.9 is 35% less than 13.7. But that's a relative risk reduction rather than an absolute risk reduction. The absolute risk reduction was 4.8%.
So if you have 100 people receiving plasma with a low level of antibodies, you'd expect about 14 of them to die. And if they were receiving plasma with a high level of antibodies, you'd expect around 9 of them to die. So although 9 is 35% less than 14, that does not mean that 35 lives were saved. Rather, 5 more people survived longer than 7 days among those receiving the high-grade plasma compared to those getting the weaker stuff. What's more, all of this is based on people who were still alive after 7 days. They also look at people who are still alive after 30 days, and the difference is smaller. But the problem isn't really the size of the alleged effect, which is certainly big enough to celebrate. The problem is that there are so many reasons, starting with the fact that the trial wasn't randomised, to think that we don't yet have any good evidence that plasma works at all as a treatment for COVID.
This study took place over a number of months, and the authors themselves recognised that during those time periods, various different other therapies were being given alongside by different doctors in different places to these patients. And it's very difficult to account for that. So some of these patients got antiviral therapies, some of them got a drug called hydroxychloroquine, some of them got steroids, and unpicking that is almost impossible.
We asked the FDA to explain the basis of their claim, and others too were questioning it online. Then, late in the evening on the day after Dr. Hahn's statement, he tweeted, "I have been criticised for remarks I made Sunday night about the benefits of convalescent plasma. The criticism is entirely justified. What I should have said better is that the data show a relative risk reduction, not an absolute risk reduction." All this doesn't mean that convalescent plasma doesn't work, it just means that we don't know yet. And there are attempts to look at this in a more rigorous way. For example, the recovery trial in the UK. It has a control group and it's randomised, and it hopes to provide some answers by the end of the year. So is there any chance that when the data are in from a solid study that we will see a benefit like 35 lives saved out of 100?
I think that's really unlikely, if only for the reason that actually 35 lives out of 100 weren't saved in this study, and randomised controlled trials usually have smaller effect sizes than are seen in observational studies like this one. So I think the chances of us having 35 people saved for every 100 are pretty much non-existent. But I hope very much that convalescent plasma does work, because I'm an ICU physician and my patients have been dying of SARS-CoV, so having effective therapy is important to me and important to my colleagues. But there's no therapy that doesn't have downsides, and so knowing that the therapies we're giving to our patients have got benefits and not just risks is really important, and at the moment we don't know that yet.
Dr. Charlotte Summers of the University of Cambridge. You're listening to More or Less. Some European countries, notably Spain, are seeing a distinct rise in cases. Is the same thing happening here in the UK? It's not completely straightforward to work that out, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, as a rising number of confirmed cases might be because of a rising number of tests, or the better focusing of tests in areas with outbreaks. Or, of course, the rise in cases might reflect a worrying reality. So how worried should we be? Long-suffering friend of the show, Kevin McConway, Emeritus Professor of Applied Statistics at the Open University, has been digging into the stats. There are three key sources published each Friday, and Kevin began with a survey conducted by the Office for National Statistics.
This is a big national survey. It takes a pretty large sample now of people from what they call the community population in England. They're not testing people because they got a symptom. They're just sampled because they're kind of representative of the population. So biases that might come from looking at people who've got symptoms don't arise.
I mean, that's very important. It's not being driven, for example, by, well, there's a spike of cases in Leicester, so we're going to do lots and lots of testing in Leicester and we'll find lots of cases because we're looking for the cases where we expect to find them. But the disadvantage is that we're actually talking about a pretty small number of cases in absolute terms.
They estimate that in 100,000 people followed for a day in England, there'd be just over 4 new infections. And they kind of scale that up to the whole population and say that's about 2,400 new infections per day. It could be half that, could be 1,200, or it could be as big as 4,000 a day because of the sampling uncertainty. Now, in a way, that sounds like quite a lot of people, but compared to all the millions of people in the country, it's really not very many.
The advantage is it removes a lot of bias. The disadvantage is there are quite wide error bars. So what is that telling us about the level of infections and whether they're going up or down?
What they're saying is that the overall level of people infected and also the level of new infections, those increases do seem to be levelling off. They can't be absolutely certain that they're levelling off because of the uncertainties involved. But if they are increasing, they're not increasing fast.
Now, we've also got tests in hospitals, there's postal tests, there's mobile testing centres, there's all these places where people are being tested for various reasons. Many, many more tests, but not a random sample. What do we learn from those tests?
Well, it's a complicated position because people are still predominantly tested because they think they've got a symptom, somebody else thinks they've got a symptom, they've been reported through the test and trace operation and so on. And therefore, if the way that people are brought in by those procedures changes over time, the number of positive tests there might be will also change over time without there necessarily being a real increase in the number of cases. It's just we may well becoming better at finding them. If you look at the test and trace reports, again, for England, they do show a kind of slow increase that's still going on. But roughly speaking, they're not a long way out of line with what's coming up in the ONS survey. And my feeling is that we can't conclude from that that there is a national increase going on. It, again, is consistent with things being roughly level.
So the overall picture, then, is a little uncertain. You've got all kinds of different issues, all kinds of different problems with the data, but there are a lot of different data sources, and they are all pointing towards the idea that the current infection rate is pretty low and almost certainly not increasing quickly.
I think it's pretty certain that it's not increasing quickly. There's a risk that it might, but I don't think it is yet. There's one data source, it's a result source rather than a data source we haven't talked about yet, which is the official pronouncements about the famous R number that also come out once a week. The one that came out last week on Friday is, on the face of it, the scariest one, because what they do each week is they give a range of values for the R number. And remember that an R number of 1 means that it's kind of a critical value. If it's below 1, then overall the number of cases is falling. If it's above 1, then overall the number of cases is increasing. So 1's a kind of important value. The week before, it was 0.8 to 1. However, this week they put up that range, so it's now 0.9 to 1.1. The committee SAGE is now saying that they certainly can't be confident that it's below 1. However, there's certainly nothing that says it has definitely gone up just because they've changed the endpoints of the range. So it might have gone up, it might not have gone up. And those numbers are a bit difficult to interpret because there are all sorts of time lags involved. A lot of the calculations are based on how many people have gone into hospital and on numbers of deaths.
Statistician Professor Kevin McConway. Why cases are rising in some European countries, but apparently not in the UK, is an important question. Perhaps it's just a matter of time. Perhaps not. I'm fairly sure we will be revisiting the question before this series is done. If you have a question or comment for us, please email moreorless@bbc.co.uk. The BBC recently reported that
breast screening women in their 40s could save lives.
Routine breast cancer screening is already offered to women in the UK between the ages of 50 and 70. The question is, what happens if you offer it to women 10 years earlier, from age 40? The answer came from research published in The Lancet, based on a study called the UK Age Trial. This trial enrolled over 160,000 women between 1990 and 1997 and followed them for an average of 23 years. Some of them were given screening every year throughout their 40s. Others, chosen at random, received screening at 50, as is standard practice. It's a large-scale and well-designed randomised controlled trial, but did it really show that screening women in their 40s saves lives? And if so, how many lives? I asked a professor of public health at the University of Sydney, Alexandra Barrett.
I think that, as the lawyers say, reasonable minds could come to different conclusions about this. So strictly speaking, the trial doesn't provide evidence that breast screening saves lives, because although in some analyses they showed that it reduces the risk of dying from breast cancer, it didn't have a big enough effect to impact significantly on the risk of dying from any cause. So what we call the all-cause mortality was not reduced.
So this is interesting and a bit puzzling. The early screening provides some evidence of preventing deaths from breast cancer, although even that depends on exactly how you slice up the data. But in any case, the early screening doesn't demonstrably prevent deaths overall. It's questionable, then, to claim that the early screening saved lives. So what's going on? All-cause mortality is a measure of death from any cause, and there wasn't a statistically significant difference in all-cause mortality between the women in the study who were screened early for breast cancer and those who weren't. But breast cancer deaths were lower. One explanation is that the screening and follow-up treatment had fatal side effects for some women. Some treatments do, but there wasn't any evidence of that in this case. Another explanation is that some deaths from breast cancer were prevented, and then the woman died from some other cause shortly after. But the basic story is probably that the breast screening simply didn't save enough lives overall to be detectable amidst the noise. It's just hard to conduct a study large enough to pick up changes in all-cause mortality unless the true effects are very large.
It's because breast cancer, particularly for women who are age 40, is a relatively rare cause of death. So in this trial, breast cancer accounted for 7% of the deaths that they observed over the follow-up period. And you reduce that by a little tiny fraction, you can see that the impact on all-cause deaths is going to be even tinier. It's going to be a really, really small difference. And therefore, you would need to have an enormous trial, hundreds of thousands of women.
Although a similar number of women ended up dying overall in the two groups, the study did find some evidence of fewer deaths from breast cancer among those who'd been screened in their 40s. By how much was the risk of dying from breast cancer reduced?
So in relative terms, it's a 25% reduction in the risk of dying from breast cancer. But in absolute terms, it's still a very small reduction. It turns out to be about one fewer death from breast cancer per 1,000 of women who actually participate in screening.
So it's quite a lot of activity to prevent one death. On the other hand, you are, if we believe the analysis, you are preventing a death. So perhaps that's worth quite a lot of activity.
That's right. Exactly. And that's where the contestability, if you like, lies. Because, as you say, if you are the one in 1,000 women whose life is saved, whose breast cancer death is prevented by participating regularly in screening, then obviously that's a really important benefit. And I guess the question that seems the most important to me then is, well, what happens to the other 999 women?
Well, so what does happen to them?
Well, they estimated that about 18% had at least one false positive.
That's just under 200 women for every 1,000 women screened.
So that's a false alarm where the screening test shows an abnormality and the woman has to go back and have more tests to sort out whether there's a breast cancer there or not. And we know from other research that women describe this as a very scary time and that it has in some women quite long-lasting psychological effects.
Screening older women, those between 50 and 70, does offer a much larger benefit in terms of reducing breast cancer deaths. It prevents 5 deaths for every 1,000 women screened. But for these older women, there are also higher risks of overdiagnosis. This is different from a false positive. A false positive wrongly detects a cancer that isn't there, and in the end, after some anxiety, more scans and tests, the woman would eventually be reassured that she didn't have cancer. Overdiagnosis is different.
It's a cancer that could have been left alone, undetected, untreated, and it would never have caused any problem to the individual within their lifetime. And it's always a risk when you go looking for disease early.
So in that situation, you would have a woman who cancer was identified, she would have to go through all the treatment, and she would think that the screening had saved her life, but in fact, had there been no screening, nobody would ever have known and she would never have come to any harm.
That's exactly right. It's one of those things that can only be measured epidemiologically or statistically. So what you have to do is look at a population of people who are screened and then compare that to a similar group who are not screened and follow them up over time to see if there's an excess number of cancers found in the screened group.
Professor Barrett says the best estimate is that around 20% of all breast cancers among women who are screened are overdiagnosed.
Unlike a lot of healthcare, screening is done to people who are well. By definition, we're doing something, offering something to people who are well, and therefore there's always the potential to make them less well than they are at that moment.
Professor Alexandra Barrett of the University of Sydney. Now for something a bit different.
This city is made of our flesh. We'll have our piece of it.
One of your girls came to me today.
You cannot steal my girls.
Give me your money and I'll make you a man.
Historical drama Harlots tells the stories of women navigating the life and the sex industry of 18th century London. A strange topic for a current affairs programme such as More or Less, maybe. But loyal listener Sarah got in touch and we live to serve.
I was struck by the claim that one in five women in 1760s London was a prostitute. That seems extraordinarily high.
With me to help answer this question is our historical sex industry correspondent, Lizzie McNeil. Hello, Lizzie. Long time no see.
Hi, Tim. Yeah, my new correspondent job isn't getting me on air as often as I'd hoped. But today I've got a big claim to look at. It appears in large letters on screen at the start of the series.
1763. London is booming. And one in five women make a living selling sex.
So, is it true? Well, I got in touch with Dan Cruikshank, a historian who wrote The Secret History of Georgian London, How the Wages of Sin Shaped the Capital.
The 18th century was a beastly time for women. Women had no rights, they had no property rights, they couldn't go into the professions. They were, you know, subjugated by men. The information one has about life in the city is often no more than informed hearsay, but there's a consistency. I discovered consistently there was a perception that one woman in five was involved in the sex industry.
And this isn't just a modern perception. Back in Georgian times, people believed the claim of one in five.
OK, but on More or Less we know that just because something is repeated a lot, it doesn't mean it's true. So what do we know about the evidence for that?
Well, there are several contemporary sources. One, the anonymous author of A Congratulatory Epistle from a Reformed Rake of 1758, who wrote,
Amongst every five women, there is at least one whore, as I can with the greatest veracity assert that among all my female acquaintance, I could never think of any five, but what I either had or could have lain with one of them.
Well, he sounds like an utter... Well, let's just say it doesn't sound like a well-researched claim.
No, a misogynist in a misogynistic society. I mean, just because he wanted to sneer about the morals of the women he knew, it doesn't really tell us much about sex workers.
Do we have any more reliable sources?
A source that Dan cites is Patrick Colquhoun, a Scottish statistician and magistrate.
And so he basically says 50,000, but then kind of whittled it down to maybe about half being actually full-time prostitutes.
Dan looked at what we know about the population of Georgian London and found that 50,000 roughly equates to one in five.
But he's not saying that all of them were full-time prostitutes.
No, roughly 20,000 of them were. The other 30,000 or so are broken down to women who occasionally resorted to prostitution when times were tough, or so-called kept women and mistresses, or women who lived with men that they weren't married to.
Right, so some of them were clearly sex workers by modern standards and some of them definitely not. I don't think unmarried cohabitation is regarded as equivalent to sex work these days.
No. Now, there is another figure, which is probably the closest thing to an official statistic that we've got.
Ooh, I like the sound of an official statistic.
A magistrate called Sanders Welsh estimated that there are around 3,000 full-time prostitutes operating in London, which seems to be based on arrest records, but...
Uh-oh. But?
Yeah, prostitution wasn't actually illegal during this time, so the woman counted would have been arrested for something else.
So it's probably a vast underestimate.
Yeah, so that figure of 20,000 full-time sex workers, which would be just under 1 in 10 women, seems to be our best estimate. Add in women who did some sex work part-time, and you probably still don't get to 1 in 5 women. But the claim was widely made at the time, and it's not completely as mad as it sounds.
It is a sobering statistic. Thank you very much, Lizzie. And that is all we have time for this week. But please send us your questions and your comments. We're at moreorless@bbc.co.uk. We will be back again, same time, same place, next week. Until then, goodbye.
More or Less was